The Centre for Climate Repair was established by Professor Sir David King to look at one of the six research themes under the umbrella of Cambridge Zero, which is carbon drawdown and climate repair. And that was set up by Dave, really with three specific scientific endeavours. One is supporting deep and rapid emissions reduction. Number two is actually, well, reducing emissions, unfortunately, isn't sufficient. And therefore, we need to go harder than getting to zero. We need to go negative. So greenhouse gas removals is objective number two. And then objective number three is worrying about the timescales over which this might unfold, and therefore the changes in areas like the poles and the Himalayas that we might therefore see as a result of our own delays. What research do we need to undertake to effectively try and refreeze the Arctic? So those are the three scientific areas of research that the Centre for Climate Repair is engaged in.
The importance of deep scientific research in getting to negative emissions, and how one of the world's leading university is bringing together like-minded individuals in that pursuit, is a theme for this week's episode. Hello and a warm welcome to yet another episode on the Mission Shunya podcast. Hope you are doing well and enjoying the season of life wherever you are on the planet. Hope the recent unseasonal overdose of harsh summers, winters, or even monsoons hasn't affected you. As you know, it's all attributed to climate change to a large extent. And in case you are wondering about my attention to seasons and climate early on in this episode, well, it's all part of this episode's theme, which I will get to in a bit. Before that, if you are a first-time listener, Shunya means zero, and this podcast aims to cover all the stories related to the global transition to the zero-carbon economy. So, if the theme is of interest, or if towards the end of this episode you want to know more, you can check the podcast playlist, which has 60 episodes so far. I'm sure you will not be disappointed. Of course, you can share your feedback. missionchunya@gmail.com is the ID. Or you can connect across the social media channels. The handle is simple, @missionchunya. In case you are a regular listener, hey, can I ask you a favor? I really want to hear from you about the show and how can I make it better. So do leave a rating and review on any podcast platform that you use. It just takes only a few minutes of your time. I regularly read all the feedback I get. Now back to the theme for this episode. It's safe to assume that we all know that climate change is real and we have to act on it. We see, hear, or know about it in different forms from time to time. But it took a lot of data and scientific rigor to prove and justify the facts over the last few decades. Now it's time, or rather high time, for global climate action. What's interesting is that it's the same scientific community that is coming together to lead us into finding novel solutions to repair the damage done to the planet. The organization featured on this episode is working to bring together experts from around the world, and one of the aims is to commercialize technology and the research in this space. The team is aptly led by a person, our guest, who has significant experience of launching products from the research labs to the market. And he is...
Hello, I am Sean Fitzgerald, Director of the Centre for Climate Repair at the University of Cambridge.
Sean, before I kind of begin the conversation, I want to congratulate you on being awarded OBE at the Queen's Honours List recently. So congratulations on that award.
Thank you very much indeed. It's all rather humbling, really, though, because the award this time was me being part of a wider and amazing team, simply just trying to help us navigate our way through this rather horrible pandemic. But it is lovely to have received the award.
Can you give us a brief background about your work during this time? As you rightly said, it's been a tough time. And how else have you allocated your busy schedule to kind of do other things in addition to what you do?
So the OBE was awarded for services to the COVID-19 pandemic, and I've been involved in many different ways, actually. So it started in the spring, very soon after the pandemic hit the UK. And so I was asked to join the SAGE Environmental Modelling Group, bringing science and engineering, and in particular my knowledge about ventilation and airflow in buildings from two angles. One is the academic research aspect in terms of airflow in buildings, and then B, the important interaction of people with buildings and building systems, how they operate, what the control systems behind all of those are, and just some of the vagaries of working with real buildings. I also got involved in helping write some of the industry guides. So I was one of the co-authors looking at the CIBSE, that's the Chartered Institution of Building Services Engineers, ventilation guidance suite of documents. And they've been updated a number of times over the course of the last 12 months as we have learned more. And then other groups that I've been involved with, the Aerosol Generating Procedures Group, the Department for Culture, Media and Sport Venues Group, and more recently, the Events Research Program, which some of the listeners may be aware of in terms of things like the FA Cup final and the fact we had attendees there. I'm part of the science board. And all of this information I'm sharing with you is just out in the public domain. None of it's confidential.
Yes. In fact, I kind of know that the work that you have done in this space, particularly around COVID-19, but I just wanted to hear from you so that the listeners are aware, because I have known you since my time in Cambridge, and you have been involved in the building ventilation space, and which we will talk about later in the show. So it's good to see that you brought that expertise to the table. And during these times, as you rightly said, ventilation, aerosols, everything is in the news, and it's kind of good to have the practices guide that you kind of put up, because it will serve a bigger purpose. So that's wonderful. Now, let's get to the theme of the discussion. Can you give us a brief background, the story about how Cambridge Zero was set up and how the Center for Climate Repair at Cambridge came about?
So Cambridge Zero was set up at about the same time as the Center for Climate Repair. And Cambridge Zero, you know, is headed up by Emily Shuckburgh, also OBE. And the remit of Cambridge Zero was really multifaceted, because there has been a lot of activity across the university already, looking at trying to help with climate change. But Cambridge Zero was established to try and help sort of draw it all together, bring it together. And there are a number of activities that it undertakes. The first is being a university with research excellence, is indeed therefore being the glue, the coordinator of different research programs in everything to do with reducing the effects of climate change so research being important, but not just research, but with our own students as an education angle, so making sure that the research learnings are then brought into the curriculum and to stimulate our students. Thirdly is looking at engagement, so clearly with our local communities, but much wider than that as well, so engagement with stakeholders, business and corporations. And then lastly is actually looking at the operations of the university, so fixing our own house, ensuring that we are bringing that into order, so reducing our own carbon emissions. So those are the sort of the big areas. And Cambridge Zero represents, there must be 1,000 academics across the university working in some various aspects to do with bringing our carbon emissions down and bringing greenhouse gas levels down and addressing climate change. So it's a massive operation overseen by Emily. And the Center for Climate Repair was established by Professor Sir David King to look at one of the six research themes under the umbrella of Cambridge Zero, which is carbon drawdown and climate repair. And that was set up by Dave, really with three specific scientific endeavors. One is supporting deep and rapid emissions reduction. Number two is actually, reducing emissions, unfortunately, isn't sufficient And therefore, we need to go harder than getting to zero. We need to go negative. So greenhouse gas removals is objective number two. And then objective number three is worrying about the timescales over which this might unfold, and therefore the changes in areas like the poles and the Himalayas that we might therefore see as a result of our own delays. What research do we need to undertake to effectively try and refreeze the Arctic? So those are the three scientific areas of research that the Center for Climate Repair is engaged in.
That's interesting to know. The three key research themes the Center for Climate Repair at Cambridge is looking at. Of course, as everyone could imagine, that Cambridge being a big university, there is a lot of research going around different departments, different researchers working around different themes. So under these three themes at Center for Climate Repair, how do you bring about the scientific research that's happening around? So what kind of support do you give people working on these themes?
So under objective number one, which is deep and rapid emissions reduction, I mean, I insert the word supporting deep and rapid emissions reduction because the other five research areas, which are under the umbrella of Cambridge Zero, include things like transport, cities and infrastructure, the zero carbon energy transformation. There are already there's already a lot of work going on in the university under bringing our emissions down. So the reason why we've put that also in the Center for Climate Repair is that I happen to have a background in buildings, as you know, and therefore supporting deep and rapid emissions reduction is something that the center is able and should be doing. But really, our area is going to be focused on supporting emissions reduction associated with the built environment, buildings, because that's my area of expertise. The other two areas, though, which are to do with greenhouse gas removal and targeted interventions to refreeze the Arctic, they're different from other research areas going on really in the university. And the big areas within greenhouse gas removal that we are focusing on are ones globally that are hitherto really underserved and have massive potential, but massive problems, or rather massive questions associated with them. Problems because it's lack of knowledge at the moment, not because they're fundamentally flawed. We just don't know. So these two areas are that we're interested in on the greenhouse gas removal front are to look at the role of giant kelp in the deep ocean. So that's growing it in the surface waters of the deep ocean and then potentially allowing it to sink. What could that do? If you think about the potential that might afford regarding the gigatons, and it is gigatons of carbon dioxide that might potentially be sequestered by that route, is amazing. But it's got big questions because no one's ever done this in the deep ocean at scale.
Correct.
And then the second area to do with oceans is to do with this technique called ocean iron fertilization. There are other techniques, similar ones being developed by other universities. But really, this is looking at what are the potential downsides as a result of seeding the ocean with missing nutrients like iron, and doing this in a very carefully planned scientific research sort of endeavor rather than at scale. We've got to make sure that we understand the processes first before one considers what might happen then if you did this at scale. And the reason why this is important is that it's got massive potential, but we've got some big questions that we need to address first and foremost regarding that we are aware of unintended consequences. So those are probably the two biggest areas in greenhouse gas removal. There are some other projects we're also working on, for example, looking at the oxidation of methane. And because that's the second greenhouse gas, really, but and it's becoming a bigger problem. The rate of growth of methane in the atmosphere is actually faster than carbon dioxide. So we've got to get to grips with that sooner rather than later. And then the traditional removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere using something called direct air capture. That's also another project that we're working on. So those are the areas within greenhouse gas removal. And then within the targeted interventions to, for example, refreeze the Arctic, look at restoring the Antarctic and the Himalayas. The one technique that we're examining in earnest at the moment is a technique called marine cloud brightening. And that's being headed up by a colleague at the engineering department, Dr. Hugh Hunt, who's the deputy director of the Center for Climate Repair.
Now, when we talk about all this technology and all the research that's been going on this space, particularly about greenhouse gas removal, at the broad level, what are the timelines that you think will be between now and when the projects can actually be scaled up at a rapid pace?
So our vision is for techniques that we're developing and exploring now, those that make it out of, you know, out of the starting blocks and are then found to be successful, should be starting to be deployed at scale within about 5 years. And that's very, very important, because if it's going to be 10, 15 years before an idea that one has now is going to see the light of day, we're extremely worried about the climate, therefore, just going through too many tipping points that will are then irreversible. So we've got to identify the approaches that could, if they work, be deployed within a shorter time scale in order to try and prevent catastrophic climate change. So the work on the oceans, for example, you know, those are the sorts of things that could be deployed at scale in anger, starting in about 5 years' time. Kelp potentially a bit shorter, but the real reason why I'm putting 5 years on the ocean-based work is that it may well take that long for us to really, really get confidence about being aware of any unintended consequences and making sure that we then either have mitigation plans in place or actually we then can it. And we say, no, we can't do this. But it's really making sure that we've got the certainty regarding not going down a path whereby we create more problems than we actually even started with. So we've got to make sure that we sort that out first, and it could easily take 5 years. I don't see why it should take longer than that, but that's why the 5 years timescale is being cited.
5 years is, in fact, a good time scale to have, especially considering what targets the UK has and also all major other countries have put forward in terms of decarbonization. Now, leading to decarbonization, from your expertise and from your experience, what are the core sectors where you feel decarbonization efforts are lacking? And where do you think there is an opportunity to add value in terms of research to implementation?
Gosh, this is such an important question. Well, interestingly, the shift in our power sector, in other words, the emissions associated with the provision of electricity, we've already made great strides, and I see ongoing great strides being made as we decarbonize. So no coal in the UK, and then basically phasing out oil and gas in particular, as we shift to mainly offshore wind, but the role of offshore wind, some solar and some nuclear as well. So that all looks, you know, manageable. You know, I can see that being a pathway that we're going to continue right now. The areas that cause me a little bit more concern are actually the ones in my own backyard in terms of research area, which is to do with decarbonizing buildings. And the biggest problem isn't the electricity provision to buildings, because that's going to be sorted out by what I've just described, but rather the heating. And the heating theoretically can be done by switching away from, let's say, oil and gas and moving to heat pumps. That can be done. But what is concerning is, one could also use hydrogen as a vector as well, but it's to do with the timescales associated with infrastructure changes. And then also, and this is really important, about the will within the community or for changing your house so that it is then fit for purpose for a heat pump. So the reason why heat pumps are great is that they have this sort of good leverage in terms of the amount of heating energy you provide to a house for a given amount of electrical energy that you put into a heat pump. It's, you know, it's a refrigerator, effectively, where you're stealing heat energy from the cold air outside and putting it inside your house, just like a refrigerator works. But in order for that process to be reasonably efficient and to work, you don't want to have a very peaky load, which means that the houses really should be well insulated. And making changes to houses, the existing building stock that are, you know, improving the insulation levels, improving the air tightness. This means commercial buildings and domestic buildings in particular, having homeowners that want to go through the disruption of having major work done on their house. And, you know, this is non-trivial about sort of how do people feel about this, about having to go through all of this change. And even with a heat pump, you know, if we say, well, Sean, you know, I'll just put a bigger heat pump in, it's not as simple as that. Because putting a bigger heat pump in, if you have the reason why you want to insulate the houses is that the radiators that you've got in your house are quite small and they're designed to work on, say, high temperature fluids being circulated through those. Heat pumps typically deliver lower temperature fluid. It's warm, but it's lower temperature. And therefore, to get the same heating output, you need bigger radiators. Well, most people don't want to have yet bigger radiators installed in their houses. I mean, I certainly wouldn't. And I wouldn't want to go through very large refurb works for my house without a plan for me not to be there whilst, for example, the builder's in for a month or two. So this is non-trivial. So it's a long answer to your question, but it's an important question. I think heating of homes is one of the biggest challenges. Existing homes is one of the biggest challenges we have regarding decarbonization.
It's interesting to know that heating plays an important role, or rather probably could be a deterrent when it comes to decarbonization. And like you mentioned, is a big challenge that is especially true for almost all the developed countries, because most of them have this particular problem with heating and insulation. And everyone, as you rightly said, heat pumps is touted to be a good solution, but people are not really comfortable using heat pumps as a solution. Now, you did mention about the work that you have done in buildings, and as a researcher who turned entrepreneur with Breathing Buildings, where do you see initiatives in Cambridge Zero and Center for Climate Repair? Do you see there are any potentials for incubating more startups in the space?
Without a shadow of a doubt, there are many more innovations that are yet to happen, and Cambridge is a fantastic place. It's not the only place, there are other universities too. But my own experience of the ecosystem of Cambridge is that it is incredibly supportive, well networked with venture capitalists, but it's the overall ecosystem that's really important, providing flexible lab space, actually academics and people around who've got experience that you can draw upon, academics who actually want to enjoy the journey too. Because not every startup's going to be a success. I was fortunate the one that I led was a success. But sometimes you make your own luck by choosing. It's not just the idea. It's choosing people with the right skills and the right, therefore the right qualities to be able to grapple with challenges that will come your way. So many of these are about forming great teams. And there's talent around Cambridge. But the same is going to be true for other universities as well. And when you've got critical mass within a town, within the university environment, then it spawns amazing results. But so there will be many more innovations, for example, in the energy transition space, new materials, new control systems, ways of optimizing systems for energy transfer, getting more out of the same wires, for example. This is not my field of expertise, but I know that there's a lot of exciting work going on.
Right. Getting more out of every system in place is actually a emerging field, as you mentioned, because system efficiency is going to be one key factor that decides how the other components fit in the puzzle. So that is good to know. Like you also mentioned, Cambridge is not going to be the only place. There are other universities. There are other researchers who are working around similar themes. So how do you think Center for Climate Repair is positioned to kind of collaborate with other universities and researchers, other similar institutions? Do you think there is going to be a global hub for projects that is going to come up?
Yes, and the vision for the Center for Climate Repair at Cambridge is as I laid out those three big research areas, but it's not to do it on our own, but rather in collaboration with experts from across the world, from different universities who bring complementary skills and interests to those particular problems. So, for example, in the world of ocean research, we're working with universities across the world. Within the UK, we have live discussions with academics from Bournemouth and St Andrews. We also have very engaged conversations and with We're planning collaborative research with teams from India, from Hawaii, and a nascent conversation in early stages with a team from Chile as well. And this is in conjunction, therefore, with other parts of ocean research with organizations based on the East Coast of the US, as well as in Holland as well. So these are just for two research areas. So it is about making sure that we are providing, the resources, the best from the work that the world has to offer. Climate change is a global problem. It needs a global solution. And that global solution is in the form of multinational, multidisciplinary collaborations.
Well said. Climate change, as you rightly said, is a global problem. So having a global solution, a global collaboration towards that is something that we all should work towards. So on a final note, Sean, you didn't mention about global actions, global collaborations, but I'm sure as an entrepreneur or even as a researcher, you always felt that even at an individual level, people can do something that is doing good for the planet. For example, decarbonization in a small way. So emissions have to be cut at every end. So what would be your recommendation or action item, if I had to put it that way, for someone who's listening and who can actually contribute in a small way in a personal capacity?
All of us as individuals can make a difference. I mean, there are some lovely maps or image graphics that are generated by others regarding, one's own carbon footprint, and what does it look like in the UK, the average UK person. Interestingly, quite a lot of that footprint starts with what we eat. and the red meat agenda, it's a big bucket. And that's possibly where we should start. And it doesn't mean necessarily eliminating red meat from your diet if you're a great fan of red meat. But it possibly does mean that actually maybe we should eat less of it. How much less? That's a personal choice. But that's what these images and infographics available, that's what they're prompting us. And then there are other things to do with the personal transport. How often do you fly? Do you fly at all? And I was very struck by a very dear friend of mine who works for Oxfam. They have a policy, which is that, for business, so when they're working, that if they can travel somewhere within 24 hours, within a working day by train, then that's what you have to do. You're not allowed to fly. If it's going to take, many days to go by train, then they will allow you to fly. But this is certainly not behavior that I was exposed to when I was working in London, for example, about 15, 20 years ago. We flew everywhere, even within the UK. And now on reflection, that was really not a great thing to have done. But that was the culture, and the climate change was just not as high up the agenda as it is now. So I think personal behaviors are, we can all look at our own carbon footprint. So I would encourage people to look at these infographics and figure out, well, where are the big ones and what could they do differently? And then, if one is fortunate and working in a research area or in a business, then there are pressures that one can put on one's employer to suggest actually these are the sorts of things that they might work on, for example, not just about behaviors, but changing products or changing research area to tackle climate change. But that all of us can certainly get involved in the way that I described at the beginning.
That's wonderful, Lyle. I like the second idea as well, because people generally think, okay, I can do this and I can stop at my home or within me. But the good thing is that you say is you're going to actually see how it can be done better. So talk to your employer, talk to your society, and make the action, compound the action, in fact, so that it impacts a wider community. So that's a wonderful thought to leave the listeners on. Sean, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for taking time and joining me on the conversation today.
You're very welcome. Very lovely to chat with you. Thank you.
That was yet another story from the realm of sustainability and global net zero transition. The Center for Climate Repair at Cambridge has been very aggressive since launch and has been one of the leading voices running up to the COP26 happening in UK later this year. To know more about their work and keep track of all their activities led by Dr. Sean Fitzgerald, follow them on Twitter. That's the best place. The links will be in the show notes section as usual and also on the webpage missionjunior.com. So I hope you got some insights from this episode. And to keep track of similar stories, subscribe to the podcast or follow Mission Shunya on social media platforms. Feel free to share it among your network if you think this could be of use to people you know. I will be back in 2 weeks' time with yet another interesting episode. So signing off, this is Girish Shivakumar, and as always, thank you for listening.